Here's May.
Good evening. This is May Brussel in Carmel, California. The time went fast. It's about 3 minutes after. Sorry about that. It is program number 502, July 19th, 1981. Losing track of time, the weeks go so fast. These nice summer days that are getting shorter with each week cause some researchers to become philosophical. I get phone calls from various people who get depressed. They don't see enough changes happening quickly, and they call sometimes just to talk about it and what's going on in the world. It isn't easy to see changes. It's hard to know if doing research is just an academic study that we do for the fun of it, or whether we really can affect changes. We don't know how much you can get done by exposing certain types of criminals to the acts that they're doing. But I think the exposing is worth it, and I think I always hope that through the research, the various people doing this kind of work are reaching other people and opening up a new, different way to look at the world than the one you get over the accepted media, the Associated Press, United Press, and the regular wire services and television and the AM radio stations. I hope it works that way. There was a good book review of about Orwell. It's called Orwell, The Transformation by Peter Stansky and William Abrams, and the book was reviewed in Nation recently, and they described Orwell's disillusionment with his own privileged class, and the book review goes into his disgust with fraud and corruption and cheats in the upper class, where he went to school at Eton and later worked for the British Empire in Burma, and how he discovered how contemptible these people were, that they were the most detestable people on earth, and he thought they were heartless and senseless, and he assumed that there had to be something better out there. And the description of his view of the world is about the way I see the ruling class very many times when I read the newspapers and study different documents. And then this description of Orwell in the reviewer talking about Orwell's attitude about the working class said that he knew nothing about this class, the alternate to the class that he hated, his own class, that he thought was senseless and cruel, must be replaced by something that must be better, the working class. And they went on to say that he never knew anything about the working class. He wanted to help them, but he never spent 10 minutes on a back street, or he would have known more about them than he wanted to know. And the article goes on, the review, to say that Orwell, Eric Blair, of course, was his name. He used the name George Orwell, described in glowing colors the other side of the fence as if it was perfect, and didn't realize that they had the same problems of wanting to achieve or obtain exactly what the people at Eton and the ruling class that he lived with had, and they were less interested in revolution than central heating or egg foo young. That was the description in the book. And then there was a quotation, the author said, it was Orwell's tragedy to have an idealistic faith in a class which was not his own, and the tragedy of that class that could not live up to that faith. And I think sometimes that applies to many researchers who want to help the blacks, the poor, the students, the Vietnam veterans, the people who are oppressed in various countries around the world, and they want to help young people in this country to see the dangers of fascism coming. But those young people really don't want to know that. They only want some of the goodies that life has to produce, and given a chance, rather than make effective changes, they just want what the ruling class has, and they're biding their time until they get it. But in summarizing Orwell's life, these people also, these two men that reviewed the book, said it is to Orwell's credit that he should have made it for the idealist that he was, who believes in false gods that may not be the way he really would want them to be, but that sometimes is preferable to the cynic who believes in nothing at all. So I could identify with this review of the life of Orwell and what Orwell hoped to achieve, and just pass on to those of you who study history or who are researchers that I personally believe it's better to hope that those people who are the victims of fascism or oppression or unfairness in our society have the capability to understand something of what we're saying or offering, or the keys to the corruption, trying to expose the people who are stepping on them and hurting them and depriving them of their rights. It's better to believe that with this information they can do something about it than to sit back and say, well, they can't do anything at all, and therefore I'm not going to bother. I'm going to just live my life the way I want, and you suffer out the way you want. I think the researcher should, who passes on in articles or letters to the editor or talk shows or buys the books that share information on these various crimes that government officials are into, those people are saying to the author, I believe in you, I believe what you're saying, or I want to learn what you're saying, and I want to include that in my wealth of information so that hopefully I'll identify these people and maybe make some changes. And that's all we can hope for. Either you want to make society a little better and you do the work for this reason, or you just study history because it's interesting, or maybe you combine the two. It's interesting and you hope you can make some changes. Briefly, I just want to mention, and all of you who listen to this show know about the death of Harry Chapin, the songwriter, the balladeer. We were having a discussion here at KLRB before I went on the air. Was this another one of those long murders that he was snuffed out, or is just a coincidence? Another singer described in the Los Angeles Times as Associated Press article, the most social and political activist in the songwriting field currently in America. Last fall, he campaigned for 5 Republicans, 19 Democrats for Congress. He raised $6 million for hunger problems or issues. He was on President Carter's commission to investigate world hunger. He, 1980, had 250 concerts, and half of them were free. He was killed in an accident in New York City. The first article in the newspaper said, "Songwriter's Death Car," and it shows the New York fireman and Harry Chapin's Volkswagen Rabbit, and it says, "This is the rabbit which plowed into a semi-trailer truck yesterday and crashed and burned and killed the 38-year-old performer who is widely known for his fight against world hunger." And then the next day, there is a photograph in the San Francisco Chronicle the day following. That one is July 17th. July the 18th, singer Chapin died driving with a revoked license, as if the piece of paper was the reason for his death. And then it shows the wreckage of his car. Rescue workers viewed the wreckage of Chapin's car, which was struck by a tractor trailer in the Long Island Expressway. And there's this huge truck that hit him from behind. And they said that he was going 15 miles an hour when this large trailer truck plowed into him, and that he had emergency lights on and was going slowly. And he died first of massive hemorrhaging in the chest cavity. He wasn't burned. The car was totally demolished. But he was described in the articles as a political activist, a person who gave free concert, who cared about political candidates, who was going off to a free concert at the time he died. He had gone to the Air Force Academy and Cornell University, an educated person using his talent as a, quotes, a social worker songwriter who did a lot of reaching out and supporting people who were less fortunate than himself. That's an Associated Press story. So Harry Chapin is gone, and we add his list to the number of musicians who have died in various ways, airplane crashes and outright murders and so-called drug overdoses. I gave a list of those musicians at the time John Lennon died. I won't repeat all 40 names now, but the list goes on, and maybe we'll update it in a month or two and just do one program on the killing of the rock musicians. There's a conference going on now, a summit in Canada. It's a different situation than the summits before when Jimmy Carter was president or Gerald Ford. We have a president whose kitchen cabinet at Stanford University and the people behind Ronald Reagan from university in Washington, D.C., and the think tanks have geared their heads towards World War III with nothing but goading the Soviet Union. And among his teamwork are people, 5 people in particular, that have been fighting each other. I named them back March 29th on the radio program here. Alexander Haig, Walter Stessel, Richard Pipes, Richard Allen, and William Casey. The next morning, it was the next noon, Ronald Reagan was shot, and Haig, of course, was competing with William Casey of the CIA, and they're still fighting. and there's infighting, and I listed in March the team members that were fighting each other. Now, they're fighting for control of the foreign policy. There's many articles on that. There was another story last week in the Sunday newspaper, Sunday magazine section, called The Confusion at Foggy Bottom. And it had the men in circles at the desk of the State Department almost identically to the people that I had named on the sheet last March. And it shows a desk with five people, and the article is about the vicar of foreign policy, Alexander Haig, and his fighting with other members of the State Department, and who's going to have control over the decisions of the State Department. Now, the minute Ronald Reagan was president, his first speech was a violently anti-Soviet speech. When Haig gave his speech, it was anti-Soviet, and as I mentioned for many weeks on the air, every time they open their mouth, they're ready to declare World War III. But our allies aren't going along with that, and the conference is going to be very different in Canada because this is the first time that the President of the United States is going to be confronted by a whole team of people that don't agree with our policies, and he was put in by those people that expect him to follow those policies through, or they could conveniently kill him or move him out of the way if he didn't go along with those policies. But even if Ronald Reagan were to drop dead tomorrow from another shot or an infection from this one, I don't think our allies in the world would go along with the crazy people that have assembled behind Ronald Reagan and put him into office. There's an article in the Washington Post by Clayton Fritchie, Consensus Against America, and it lists the opinion of our allies on very many things. The avowed aim of the Reagan administration, this article says, is to forge a global anti-Soviet consensus. Instead, the emerging critical consensus seems to be directed against the United States. It lists the 50 nations of the Organization of African Unity against the United States and South Africa, West Germany, the marches against world tension and arms race, France's new foreign minister talking about our failures in developing underprivileged countries in the world, the decision in Pakistan to give them atomic weapons to provoke India, Japan rejecting our pressure to build up their arms, and they have many beefs against us. Four members of the U.S. country team attached to the American embassy were expelled from Zambia as being members of the CIA, and they were kicked out. And next door in Mozambique, they kicked out other people that they said were from the CIA. And this article goes into many of the problems with the president of Mexico and our agreement or disagreement in Central America and what we're doing in El Salvador and Guatemala and the Honduras and Nicaragua. And it goes into George Bush going to Paris to admonish Mitterrand and being told, Mitterrand told him I don't have to, you know, jiggle or dance to your tunes or Reagan's orders. This is a time where our president is always smiling and waving and happy, but he's going to meet some people who are going to have to go into their countries and say, well, we're not going to take orders from Haig or Allen or Bush or Stessel or Pipes or any of you. And they're really afraid of American foreign policy. Another article, the White House shifts the summit duties from Bush to Deaver. Ronald Reagan isn't completely stupid. He didn't get to be president for nothing. And all of a sudden, instead of the vicar, Alexander Haig, being in charge of the Ottawa conference, Reagan got smart and he changed away from Bush to Deputy of Staff Michael Deaver, because that's a long friend he can trust, and Haig and this gang are brutal, and I think he's figuring out what's going on there and relying on old friends instead of the team that are trying to do him in and bulldozing him with disinformation. Last time I went to Canada, and I'm sure he even knows much about the Hinckley family. If I can figure it out, I think he can figure that out too. Another article, who's in charge of foreign policy? In the New York Times, it's got Alexander Haig and Richard Allen. And it tells how former presidents handled foreign policy, how John Kennedy, Richard Nixon, and Jimmy Carter literally made decisions for themselves, that Dean Acheson, John Foster Dulles, and Henry Kissinger were the men that ran the foreign policy for Truman, Eisenhower, and Ford, but that Reagan has come to no particular course because the vicar of foreign policy, this is the New York Times, Alexander Haig, came in wanting to be crisis management, wanted to be in charge of all the foreign policy, and that he's fighting with other people in Washington, D.C., and The question is, should they give that much power to Haig? And our allies are afraid of Haig, even though he was the head of NATO, and there's a big problem there. Another article last Sunday's paper about a member of Congress, the Senate, Senator Spark Matsunaga from Hawaii, and he went to a dinner party in the White House, and Haig and the gang kept pushing him in the back room where the Japanese prime minister was the guest of honor. And the poor man kept coming out, and they pulled him in with the other Japanese. And then finally, Haig went through the line and started to shake his hand. And he said, well, I was one of the people in the Senate that confirmed you. He didn't recognize the senator and put him in the back room with some Japanese guests. And there was a cartoon and an article about Haig pulling that. And the Washington Post had an editorial and article, Reagan's Soviet Illusion. And it says, Reagan is mortgaging his policy to a single, extreme, arbitrary, and historically unproven concept of Soviet power. Another article in the New York Times, speech on foreign policy being deferred by Reagan, and a cartoon in the Houston Post, Sunday, July the 5th, Ronald Reagan, it's a movie poster advertising a movie, Bedtime for Brezhnev. And it's got a picture of Nancy down below, co-starring Nancy Davis. And then there's George Bush in a cowboy hat, and Haig is a cowboy, and Henry Kissinger is a cowboy, and Gaddafi, and Brezhnev, and Castro. And it shows Ronald Reagan being really tough, far out of the West. And it shows, see dashing Ronald Reagan in his greatest and bravest role. Watch our ageless hero uphold international law and order in unprecedented fashion. And it goes on, Bedtime for Brezhnev, and so forth. Thank goodness our allies, our major allies, are as much afraid of him as I am, and they're closer to where the bombs would be falling. So the conference will be interesting because our president and his advisors are going to be put on the defensive. And while they act very charming and all peace and love at this conference, other people are going to go home to their countries and have to report what is happening, and I'm sure that Haig's policy or bloodbath in Central America may be a little diluted between this and the conference in the Caribbean. He's already backing down on some of his policies, but he's mean enough right now. The newspaper, the Anti-Castro Cubans, are advertising in the New York Times, Washington Post, Houston Post have articles. They're going to kill Fidel Castro. There's an anniversary of the Bay of Pigs operation, the military. The Alpha 66, trained by the CIA, the Houston Post, Castro's death will be repeated. The head of the Cuban commando group said that Castro will be killed by trained assassins July 26th. We'll see if that happens or not. The CIA group that said they work with the United States Army, trained in the United States, are going to try to kill Fidel Castro. I saw that in every newspaper that I take. They're quite open about it, and right now in Washington, the FBI is investigating possible violation of Neutrality Act that forbids private citizens from conducting foreign policy, but I'm sure it comes right out of the National Security Council, and they're very anxious to do it. They are planning the assassination. They say they know how to do it, and they will do it. In the meantime, there's a fever that hit Cuba. 31 people have been killed, and it was a disease. 79,000 people were sick in Cuba and 100 to 200 in Dominica. Now, that's the little island that was supposed to be invaded just recently. And I wonder if there's biological tampering there with people so their resistance is down. The reports of casualties came, interestingly enough, out of the Disease Control Center in Atlanta, Georgia, and also the other one out of Fort Collins in Colorado. Those are the two areas that keep these kinds of weird medications that could cause those deaths and diseases. And people's resistance could be down at the time of the planning of the killing or having a coup in Cuba. They're very anxious to do it, and they're very open about what they intend to do. I received from one of the subscribers to my tapes an article from the San Francisco Examiner. It's about the Vatican and the Pope and how the Pope appointed a new archbishop in the Polish capital. But then the article goes on to say, this particular bishop visited Rome last week and led a group of Poles to St. Peter's Square to listen to a tape message from the Pope recovering from a suicide attempt. It's interesting that the Examiner described the shooting of the Pope, of course, it's just an error, but it's an interesting thing that it got through the press, that because we don't hear much about the assailant, either the one that shot at Ronald Reagan or the Pope, it's interesting that the news carried it as a suicide. The Pope isn't going to Lourdes. He's supposed to go this week. He's too sick to go to Lourdes. That was in the Los Angeles Times, and I thought it was kind of interesting. Lourdes is a place where Catholic people go to be cured for various diseases, and the Pope turned down an invitation to attend the Eucharist Congress in Lourdes. It'll be 2 days from now because he has a virus and blood condition from the surgery wounds that when he was shot May 13th. If Lourdes could cure the Catholics, he ought to go there and get cured. That's where they go, in wheelchairs and crutches. And if he believes in Lourdes and lures the other Catholics on, maybe he ought to go there. Another article. Last week I mentioned the Vatican's losing money, and this is a very serious thing because it ties in with American banks and organized crime and the possible motive for shooting the Pope at this time, the interlocking links of this Pope with Pope Paul VI and the way the money transacted out of the Vatican into other sources. This week they had an update. The Vatican is feeling another $26 million pinch, the most dramatic growth of the deficit that they faced so far. It'll double next year, and they had figures of last year's loss. And then the article from the paper this week said the Vatican will have trouble raising money because if the Pope has to curtail his public appearances and travel plans because of his injuries, the church will be in worse financial situations, and that they help raise money when he travels. I remember when he took a trip to the Philippines this last year, and they had just announced a $19 million deficit. And I said he went over there to pick it up from the Marcos. He can travel and pick up money. This article says that they do, in fact, pick up money when he travels, so he better get well soon. And just one more comment about that, because I've done so many programs on the Vatican and their problems linked to the American intelligence community and various banking scandals that are taking place. They're planning a great big trip for the Pope to Great Britain, and this was described in a newspaper in New York, the New York Post. A man who built a financial empire of sports people, tennis people, and other sports, Mark McCormick, is arranging the trip of the Pope, a $2 million a day papal visit to Britain next year, and they're going to sell him like a superstar, and they're arranging, the people that arrange sports events are going to handle the Pope's trip as soon as he gets well. I guess that'll take care of some of the deficit. I just bring this up. It's interesting to me the complications of the way an organization that was so wealthy and so powerful all of a sudden came to lose so much money, and they said they'd have to raise money from the churches around the country and the various Catholics because they're in such dire straits. The entrapment of people with swindlers doesn't fall just to single individuals. Here's a whole institution like the Vatican that's in such trouble, and it's a shame. I don't feel sorry for them, but it's a shame that countries like Israel that are religious countries, or the Vatican that is a religious institution, and other agencies that are allegedly for religious purposes get tangled with organized crime, with mob figures, with warfare states, with the CIA, with intelligence communities. It's a shame that they get tangled and brought down to the level of these people and then have to go begging for money while the mob keeps rolling in all its money for dope and heroin and cocaine and illicit drug traffic, prostitution and extortion and you name it, and can even tangle an institution like the Vatican into its control and tie up its finances the way it managed to do. I have mentioned on the program when I talked about the shooting of Ronald Reagan, the Hinckley family, John Hinckley Sr. We don't see much of John Hinckley Jr. He's not going to be visible, I guess, till August, and maybe they'll indict him for the shootout in Washington of four people, including the President of the United States. But in April, several months ago, I talked about an organization that the Hinckley family was involved in, World Vision, because the night or the next day after Ronald Reagan was supposed to die, the Hinckley family was allegedly moving to Guatemala. And I mentioned a quotation from the Wall Street Journal about the Hinckley family that John Jr. belonged to this white supremacy group, and its avowed purpose was to preserve the memory of Hitler, but that the family, his father, was a consultant to World Vision International. Some of you might remember that. I talked about that, that it's a it was described in the Wall Street Journal as a huge interdenominational aid organization with projects in 85 third world countries. And World Vision was described in a magazine called Christian Century as being part of the AID Defense Pentagon program in Cambodia, in Southeast Asia, in Biafra, Algeria, that they prolonged the war, the civil war, and funded money over there, and that they had ties to the CIA and participated with U.S. military activities. And I think it's important because of their links to the Pentagon and the CIA, because the Bush family were friendly with the Hinckley family, and the sons were to have dinner the next night. If Ronald Reagan, the night after the shooting, these two sons were to get together. And there were certain common denominators between the Houston, Texas area, John Connally, Edward Bennett Williams, the attorney for Hinckley's son. There was a group of people from Houston, Texas, and the Southwest there, and Denver, Colorado, that was very close, and I referred to them, this was last April, about that the World Vision and the CIA. Now, this last week, I got from the Salvadoran Wire Service some more information about World Vision and particularly their activity in Honduras and Guatemala, and that they work for the CIA and that it is a spy front. That's what they're saying down in Salvador. And it's interesting because the Salvadorian invasion of American troops was to cause these people to go over to Guatemala and Honduras as refugees. And in those areas, World Vision set up their headquarters to receive them and indoctrinate the people, to spy on them, to cause arrests of people who managed to get out of El Salvador. And the Salvadoran Wire Service was making connections this past week to World Vision. And the family, as I say, of John Hinckley Sr. has strong tentacles in Guatemala. And I think that the people, the Pentagon and the CIA, Bush, George Bush, the Vice President, Alexander Haig, John Connally, John Hinckley Sr., and we don't know how close John Hinckley Jr. was to his dad, all have a relationship to events down in Central America that should be opened up. I don't think that sequestering John Hinckley Jr. Should just silence the, who the family is or what they have and their connecting links to the bloodbath in Central America. I think there's much to be opened up there. And as I say, the Salvadoran Press has an article, North American religious sect involved in police work. Over 100,000 Salvadoran refugees located in Guatemala and Honduras have accused the North American World Vision of ties to the CIA. This news release says that World Vision Church Group are accused of spying and informing on those fleeing the civil war in El Salvador. The Vision is located throughout refugee camps and preaches misleading doctrines such as stay away from the priest, don't touch the priest, Fidel Castro will take your children from you, communism will take everything you have. Here they have left El Salvador and everything that they ever had, and they're told not to trust the priests who are helping them in, at the refugee camps. I'll take a one-minute break, and I want to do a little more about World Vision and some other interconnecting links that are important. We'll take a one-minute break and then get back to that.
This concludes the first half of World Watchers International with Mae Brussel. We will return with the second half after a brief pause.